Hello and welcome to the Return of the Repressed, dear listeners. We have a lot to get through. We have already, to summarize, been given some insight into what can be called proletarian science. And we have studied the early rise of Lysenko. We began our journey with the general structuring of scientific policy after the revolution and the half or so century which preceded it. We will now return to those first years after the Civil War in the 20s to understand better the Koltsov-Serebrovsky clan and some of their political backers who had the upper hand during most of the 20s before perishing towards the end of the 30s, hitting a few rough patches along the way. Cliffhangers about Darwin's forgotten book and the mysterious fate of Paul Kammerer will remain looming in the distance, but I promise we will get there once we do know what is at stake. What is at stake relates to that which was hinted at when we last mentioned that old Frenchman Jean-Baptiste. A fermenting conflict between neo-Lamarckianism and neo-Darwinism, eugenics on the left and right, genetics and epigenetics. In a forum permeated by high hopes for dialectics, the demarcation lines between these groupings are not as strict as we might have hoped. There were, for example, Lamarckian eugenicists, just as there were Darwinian skeptics of genetics, etc. There were more outspokenly goal-orientated theories of evolution, such as orthogenesis, those which saw laws rather than chance, such as nomogenesis, those which saw perfection, inertia or irreversibility, and dozens of other theories, anti-theories, confusions and synthesis. There were mechanical interpretations, vitalist, programmatic, organic, pre-formationist, etc. Boris M. Zawadowski, who together with Serebrovsky had been a student of Koltsov for more than a decade by the time of the revolution, the early days before their teacher became a fanatical eugenicist, would himself after the revolution go on to develop a Marxist approach to museology and characterized the quote-unquote crisis of evolutionary theory as follow in 1924. Quote, "We are still lacking a uniform and generally accepted system that would incorporate and reconcile all those seemingly contradictory facts and phenomena that have been accumulated by experimental biology and genetics in the last 25 years. The problems of identifying external and internal causes of morphogenesis, exactly determining the laws of heredity, the interpretation and meaning of the concept of hereditary units, or genes, quote-unquote, the issue over the inheritance of acquired characteristics, the relative significance of modifications, mutations, and combinations in the evolutionary process, and a host of other hotly debated issues of evolutionary theory all still continue to divide contemporary biologists in two often irreconcilable camps." End of quote. The problem of this irreconcilability, as he saw it, was a contradiction brought to ever more antagonistic levels by the fact that everyone tried to be the best Marxist, the most dialectical thinker. Quote, "We are sometimes done a disservice by Marxist biologists and those Marxist popularizers who have never really analyzed the essence of some biological issue, but who nonetheless urge us biologists to take a certain side because it seems to them more in keeping with the spirit of dialectical materialism." End of quote. analyzing the experiments on the inheritance of acquired characters with a geneticist lens, he said, quote, historical testing has overwhelmingly favored neo-Darwinism, and by contrast, has forced us to throw out many naive and popular ideas which Lamarckists had brought into the life sciences. Modern scientific data persuades us to the dominant influence of internal factors, of preformism in the process of evolution, as compared with the limited effect of epigenetic factors of the external environment, end of quote. I bring this up for a couple of reasons. First off, it's a pretty good summary of the confusion of the decade which we are dealing with. But more importantly, is that this statement shows us that the Lamarckians, and much later the Michurinists surrounding Lysenko, were not being hyperbolic when they criticized the Koltsov-Serebrovsky clan for believing in the, quote, preformism in the process of evolution, end of quote. We will soon see why that is important to remember. Another reason is that Zawadowski, despite being a fellow traveler of the reductionists, furthermore admitted, quote, the necessity of continuing the search for external factors eliciting hereditary variation, end of quote. And I think some of you might surely have begun to wonder by now. If our protagonist came onto the scene with the help of Vavilov in 1928, why did it seem like a nascent anti-Lysenkoism was already in violent puberty by the early 30s? What reasons could they have had for hating him before they even knew who he was? Well, Marxists of that time, including scholars in the social sciences, biologists, and medical researchers, as we can see, were far from unanimous on the issue, and tended to sympathize with the Lamarckian approach. Even some students of Koltsov were Lamarckian before they got gradually lost in the fruit fly labyrinth, which, as we know from the last episode, according to Serebrovsky himself, produced nothing for the national economy. Actually, the majority of the big names within biology of the 19th century up until the 20s were Lamarckians, such as Charles Darwin, Ernst Haeckel, and Herbert Spencer, etc. Even the co-founder of the American eugenics movement, Henry Fairfield Osborne, whom we will meet again as the president of the American Museum of Natural History, was a Lamarckian. But the Lamarckian predominance would begin to change in 1926 when Kammerer committed suicide and suspicious Western, supposedly communist, guests brought in different synthetic ideas to the Soviet Union. Our contemporary hatred for Lamarckism, the inheritance of acquired characteristics, in short, epigenetics, is mainly a retroactive revisionism, initially outlined by Julian Huxley's first anti-Lysenko campaigns at the UNESCO in the 40s, the Caltech Rockefeller Drosophila Mafia and their dominance from the 50s onwards, as well as the new atheist pop biology of the likes of Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris, etc., which began in the 1970s. Our time focus of interest, the 20s, was a time when disagreements divided Marxists not only over biological issues, but also over issues in other scientific fields. The strong trend towards mechanistic materialism, what we might call vulgar Marxism, which was evident in the editorial boards of philosophical journals and in the administration of scientific institutions, had not yet been overcome. It was not without cause that the authoritative Marxist historian M.N. Pokrovsky president of the Socialist Academy, later named the Communist Academy, stated in 1923, quote, "In our Marxist circles and in the ranks of the party, the cleavage over basic methodological issues has without doubt acquired dimensions great enough to demand our attention," end of quote. Wow, academic Marxists disagreeing to a point that might even bring evolution itself to a halt. I don't believe it. The simple answer to the Lysenko question is that those who wanted to get rid of him saw him as a threat to their contemporary origin myths. The ghost of Aristogenesis, the Galtonian genius demon who runs around in the blood of the most obnoxious around us, making them feel superior to others, be they Marxist or whatever. Because, you know, in their minds, noble mutations are very rare. Thus, essentially, geniuses are picked by nature itself. Unless, perhaps, we can act as gods and x-ray them forward. Now, that's a bit of a joke with some truth in it, but try to remember the word Aristogenesis, for I will make a more serious point later. Lysenko's enemies assume and assumed erroneously that his practical project was based solely on Lamarckism, because they didn't like that he picked up the call by Zawadowski of, quote, "continuing the search for external factors eliciting hereditary variations," which he did, since a more mature Zawadowski, who knew Koltsov and Serebrovsky better than most, had told a new generation of Soviet scientists that, quote, "the dispute between Lamarckism and Darwinism is largely rhetorical," end of quote, which it was and is. Yet the adversaries wanted to continue to focus exclusively on the gene. They had no time, in their own words, as mentioned, for grounded experiments in the vast and contradicting universe that is epigenetics. That is why crypto-eugenicist Richard Dawkins has claimed that epigenetics is just a mere trend for almost half a century, long before he received Oxford's new, for him created, pop science chair, with the help, again, surprise, surprise, of an exiled Soviet scientist recruited by Microsoft. No contradictions here, since Gates, of course, gets hard as fuck at the inherently fascist thought of us being, quote, "robot vehicles blindly programmed to preserve the selfish molecules known as genes," end of quote. Ah, yes. The selfish gene. The only one who seems surprised that this would become the very scientific basis of neo-Nazism and Reaganism in the 80s, or Thatcherism, is Dawkins himself. But then again, even his Pikachu face of "I can't believe it" when asked about this in interviews isn't that convincing. Let's say for now that the universe is not a clockwork, no TikTok, and no God as the one who winds it up. Let's say it's an hourglass. Or rather, let's view the history of the idea that is heredity as an hourglass, as suggested by the Kaiser Wilhelm Society itself in one of their latest publications called A Cultural History of Heredity. Let me briefly show you what they mean by that. In the early modern period, thinking in terms of heredity started to take hold in a broad epistemic space that incorporated elements from different contexts, such as medicine, breeding, and trade. This is the surface of all the sand before it begins to fall, the broadest segment that makes out the top and our beginning. This development created a set of coordinates that made it possible to conceive of reproduction no longer only as a personalized and individual generation of offspring, but also as the transmission and redistribution of a more or less atomized biological substance. Heredity thus not only moved into the center of the life sciences in the course of the 19th century, it also assumed a powerful biopolitical dimension. This conjunction created a research dynamic in the late 19th and the early 20th centuries, by which the idea of heredity was condensed into epistemic things, most prominently genes, that could be traced and manipulated experimentally. That's the middle meeting point of the glasses, where only a single pebble of sand can get through, and as it does, it is deemed a gene. The point where the two cones meet as mirror images of each other, if you are following the metaphor. Then the glass broadens once again with the help of the research technologies as well as their political and economic contexts associated with classical and molecular genetics, respectively the two disciplines that have defined the 20th century as the quote-unquote century of the gene. As such, the reification of heredity is beginning to be reversed again in the current conception of the genome and in the strategies developed to study its interactions with the body. A spatialization of the concept seems to take place once more. This time, however, not in relation to disparate domains of practice brought together, but rather from within and out towards these disparate domains of practice. Nowadays, the epistemic space of heredity manifests itself in the increasingly complex internal structures and architectures of the cellular machinery serving the transmission and expression of traits. Both heredity and the gene have fallen all over the broad bottom space and wants to inform all things from which it first came. But it does so from the onset of the epistemic object, the gene, and the point when it, as a single thing, fell through the middle of the hourglass. It has become the malleable matter of politics, familial affairs, and the marketplace once more. What used to be the bedrock and very substance of cultural traditions was for a while reduced to universal laws of nature, only to emerge as a repository for shaping the future of humanity. In short, a broad epistemic space became one epistemic thing only to determine again an entire epistemic space. That the hour would strike Jean at the exact same time as Julian Huxley declared that the eclipse of Darwinism was over, when he got Rockefeller on board with his modern synthesis, and that it would coincide with one of the greatest events of the evolution of human modes of production, was a historical misfortune for Lysenko and all those with a different reading of Darwin and Marx which did not involve eugenics. In contrast, I imagine, the Soviet Weizmannists, the bourgeois intelligentsia which surrounded Koltsov and Serebrovsky, could not believe their luck, that they were born to be scientists under a state that gave more funds to the biomedical sciences than any other on the planet. And that the neo-Lamarckians would begin to turn neo-Darwinians en masse as the X-ray mutational update to the gene theory was discovered in 1926, just at the same time as Kammerer became a scandal, shows that a lot was going on at the same time. Almost a bit too much, if you want my honest opinion, as it kept the final unspoken goal of the whole eugenic project in an ambivalent mist, despite the global rise of fascism during a coked-out 20s. Remember, 1926 saw the junta January coup d'etat in Greece. Soon the same events followed in Poland in May, Portugal in July, then Lithuania in December. It saw warlord Chang Zuolin's capturing of Beijing and the Kuomintang's launching of the northern expedition. Trotsky and Kamenev were thrown out of the Politburo. Henry Ford declares class peace with a 5-day work week, while the UK declared martial law during some of its greatest millions-strong miner strikes, eventually banning sympathy strikes and general strikes altogether. Sweden got their own Svenska Fascistiska Folkparti. Hirohito became emperor. Franco received the title of Generalissimo. And the Partito Nazionale Fascista of Benito became the only legal party. All in the same year. One of the first references of the Japanese Lysenkoist school, F. Dushinsky, a member of the Soviet Communist Academy and a classical Darwinist who based his reasoning on natural selection and the inheritance of acquired characteristics, highlighted this suspicious ambivalence in a critique of Serebrovsky, which I think is valid to this day. Quote, "These statements about genes reminds us of earlier vitalistic propositions which have been somewhat modified. Earlier we heard about such metaphysical entities as entelechy, life force, and soul, which direct all living processes but which exist and act completely independent of the body. Now we hear about autonomously existing material genes, developing and influencing the nature of the organism according to their own immanent laws." End of quote. This was, in a way, the general critique of the Weizmannists, and that is why they fell in love with the X-ray mutation discovery of Hermann J. Müller at Columbia under Fruit Fly Morgan in 1926. Because even though that was an experiment proving that external factors had an effect on the immortal, unchangeable gene, they knew that if they embraced it, the critique of them all believing in metaphysical immanent laws fell apart. It became more difficult for their opponents to show that geneticists essentially believe in some kind of preformationism, in which an indestructible code has always already been written, only to eventually manifest itself as a sentient human. Preformation, it should be noted, envisioned that organisms develop from miniature versions of themselves. I beg the listener to look up its father, one of the inventors of the microscope, the Dutch alchemist Nicolaas Hertzøker, who, right after having invented this tool during the second half of the 1600s, of course masturbated on it and examined his sperms, where he, much to his surprise, saw small tiny people, which he called homunculus. Oh, that's me! For sure not, you absolute jerk off! Most importantly, though, with mutation research being recognized as the cutting edge, the tone of the debates changed dramatically now that only certain people had access to certain machines which could see certain things. Suddenly, Serebrovsky started using very different words when describing his opponents. Quote-unquote naive Lamarckism and quote-unquote layman biologist became popular code words used to separate scientists into different classes of authority. This is the objective elitism which we have been discussing since the very first episode of the first season. The most zealous among the eugenic clan, literally mocked with irony, attempts to vindicate Kammerer and claim that all further research on the inheritance of acquired characteristics would be futile, while authoritative references to the supposed communist from the West Miller increased in frequency. In 1927, Serebrovsky published a paper called Four Pages That Shook the Scientific World, which declared the inheritance of acquired characteristics as a false doctrine. It spoke of enormous practical possibilities for plant and animal breeding, as well as the quote-unquote improvement of man. Seriously, fuck you, Serebrovsky. Rockefeller lends you an X-ray and some fruit flies, and suddenly you are the Obi-Wan Kenobi of genetics. He timed the publication to appear in Pravda on the same day as the 5th International Congress of Genetics opened in Berlin. The Soviet geneticists present outnumbered even the Americans, and it demonstrated, as Serebrovsky boasted, quote, to the whole world, both quantitatively and qualitatively, that in a great agrarian country, genetics quickly assumes the position predetermined for it by that country's economic premises, end of quote. President of the Congress was Erwin Bauer, chairman of the Berlin Society for Racial Hygiene, whom in the same year had founded the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute of Anthropology, Human Inheritance and Eugenics. A devoted Nazi who later reassured the new rulers in his own words, quote, that none else approves of the sterilization laws of the Reich government more than me. But this is only a beginning. As I must always stress, it is only a beginning. End of quote. It was Bauer, you will recall, whom in 1921, together with two other top hyenas of the movement, Eugene Fischer and Fritz Lenz, wrote Grundriss der menschlichen Erblichkeitslehre und Rassenhygiene. This basic theory of human heredity and racial hygiene was, according to Hitler, the major inspiration for his racial tenets as he wrote his book in the Landsberg prison. It was at the Berlin Congress that the arguments against genetics by Soviet Lamarckians and their Marxist philosophical sympathizers lost all their significance. Serebrovsky gloated and tried to reassure the perceived losers on how to read the situation. Quote, several of our Russian comrades consider it an ideological minus of the Congress that it devoted almost no attention to the issue of the inheritance of acquired characteristics, so hotly debated in Moscow. And in fact, only one of the 150 reports was devoted to Lamarckism. However, even if there are reactionary geneticists and especially eugenicists, it does not follow from the scant attention to Lamarckism that modern genetics is reactionary. End of quote. I would disagree with Serebrovsky. I think precisely that since only one Soviet biologist was allowed to report on Lamarck, that is, that only one voice of 150 did not deem it an awaited world historical defeat, that Kamerad had died a mysterious death together with the theory of the inheritance of acquired characteristics, proves that internationally speaking, with the USSR as a twilight exception, modern genetics had become a reactionary movement which completely ignored any other theory. The synthetic theory of evolution had become totalitarian. Serebrovsky is almost a bit too cute when he said, quote, in contrast to several other international congresses held this year, the Berlin Congress strongly emphasized the international cooperation of different nations, and our German hosts expressed their satisfaction that all countries responded to their invitation to meet in Berlin. Yes, why does everybody want to come to Berlin? The Communist Academies journal, which had increasingly found itself on the side of Koltsov-Serebrovsky, nonetheless had to note in an editorial, quote, the author of the report is himself an experimental biologist, they're talking about Serebrovsky, and did not participate in the eugenics section, and as a result his report does not sufficiently illuminate a series of fundamental issues in eugenics which were handled in a bourgeois way in that section and the one on human genetics. And a few months later, Serebrovsky's colleague, M. L. Levin, sharply criticized his optimism by speaking of the dangers of, quote, anti-Semitic fascist eugenists, which have been proliferating of late, that is, extreme right-wing bourgeois geneticists, who raise directly the question of using the power of government to achieve their bone-crushing eugenic goals by preparing for a fascist takeover and popularizing a racial war, end of quote. Quite a foresight. And in the next episode we will get into the hardcore debates of the 30s, as Lysenko came to the rescue of the opposition to genetic reductionism, in a time in a milieu that had turned 180 degrees, when neo-Darwinism rather than neo-Lamarckism had become the new status quo. Though a threatened status quo in the Soviet Union, which had begun to suffer the consequences of having occupied the hegemonic seat. That is to say, a lot of fucking promises, but very little to show for. For now, let's note that much water had flowed under the river since the days of Nicholas Herzegger, and alchemical preformationism in the days of the microscope's discovery. Thus, bourgeois scientists, having replaced the aristocrats in toto, also had other causes than synthetic and semi-synthetic stimulants to be getting high. In the first decades of the 20th century, successes in tissue and organ transplantation, immunization, blood transfusions, cell and tissue cultivation, serodiagnostics, that is blood testing, hormone, vitamin, x-ray, chemo and antitoxins therapies, and in the deciphering the basic mechanisms of heredity and embryonic development, generated a euphoric vision. Science could control life, death, and disease. Of course, none of this is inherently bad. I do not have any a priori objections to the so-called life sciences on conservative or religious grounds, but with godlike powers comes, well, godlike powers. And the scale of what can go wrong is omnipresent. When one gets obsessed with death, as gods seem to be, death of a being or the death of a race, the genealogical desire to do some weird shit just for the sake of it, or to save one's heredity, starts to grow. These hygienic notions, despite its Puritan overtones, start to grow like mold in the Petri dish. Maybe the Weismannists had forgotten that even these natural phenomena have their genealogy. Thanatos' twin brother of hypnosis and sleep, both born of the incestual marriage between Earth's gloom, Nyx and Erebos. For those well versed in Greek mythology, you already know how chaotic things will get when we meet their respective mother and father. So let's venture into that mystery. Let's leave the debates for a while and study, with the help of the earliest sci-fi and some real science, how these privileged lab coats in the USSR sought to control life and death, leaving a legacy of popular conflict which Trofim Lysenko had to inherit against his will, since, as we know, he never even considered himself a Lamarckian. This is a dark place, dear listener, but more fun than a lengthy theoretical description of the history of ideas of Soviet biology, one which includes dog heads without bodies, radiation-treated monster eggs, immortal superhumans and mass artificial insemination with the seed sperms of apes and Vladimir Lenin. Listen to the rest of this episode, please subscribe to the Patreon or on Spotify. If you subscribe, you will not only learn more about Lysenko and the days when genetic reductionism took over, you will also be given access to well-researched extended series that will take you on a long journey through the parapolitical history of cannabis, the murder of the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme in the 80s, or how New Ageism, ufology, and the ancient aliens narrative came to be through the Stargate conspiracy, as well as other upcoming future originally researched projects that you will not find anywhere else. I live in a small house in a small Alp village with my partner and a young boy, tending a natural farm with an old man in his 70s. I wish to make this podcast show my full-time job whilst providing my local retired community and kindergarten with good, healthy food. It's very difficult for me to maintain regular office jobs as a diagnosed psychotic, so please consider supporting this project with a few dollars. Thank you very much, and hope to see you there soon.